No, of course not. But for now, senseless forward motion was all that mattered, because that was all there was left.
Arriba, you bastard, he cried, chasing Ted into the dining room.
Ted had his hands up to his head and was waving them about his ears. He looked like a man beset by bats. The umbrella did look a little bat-like as it lashed up and down.
Help me, Ted squealed. Help me, man's gone crazy.
But they were all backing away, eyes wide and scared. Ted's hip struck one corner of the buffet. The table rocked forward and upward, silverware sliding down the inclined plane of the wrinkling tablecloth, plates falling and shattering on the floor. Arberg's Waterford punch bowl detonated like a bomb, and a woman screamed. The table tottered for a moment and then went over.
Help! Help! Help!
Andale! Gardner brought the umbrella down on Ted's head in a particularly hard swipe. Its trigger engaged, and the umbrella popped open with a hollow whoosh. Now Gardner looked like a mad Mary Poppins, chasing Ted the Power Man with an umbrella in one hand. Later, it would occur to him that opening an umbrella in the house was supposed to be bad luck. Hands grabbed him from behind. He whirled, expecting that Arberg was over his impropriety attack, and was back to have another go at giving him the bum's rush. It wasn't Arberg. It was Ron. He still seemed calm, but there was something in his face, something dreadful. Was it compassion? Yes, Gardner saw that was what it was. Suddenly, he didn't want the umbrella anymore. He threw it aside. The dining room was silent, but for Gardner's rapid breathing and Ted's harsh, sobbing gasps. The overturned buffet table lay in a puddle of linen, broken crockery, shattered crystal. The odor of spilled rum punch rose in an eye-watering fog. Patricia McCardle is on the telephone talking to the cops, Ron said. And when it's Back Bay, they show up in a hurry. You want to bug out of here, Jim. Gardner looked around and saw knots of partygoers standing against the walls and in the doorways, looking at him with those wide, frightened eyes. By tomorrow, they won't remember if it was about nuclear power or William Carlos Williams or how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, he thought. Half of them will tell the other half I made a pass at his wife. Just that good old, fun-loving, wife-shooting Jim Gardner going crazy and beating the shit out of a guy with an umbrella. Also dumping about a pint of Chivas between the teeny tits of the woman who gave him a job when he had none. Nuclear power? What did that have to do with it? What a Christless mess, he said hoarsely to Ron.
Shit, they'll talk about it for years, Ron said. The best reading they ever heard, followed by the best party blow-off they ever saw. Now get going. Get your ass up to Maine. I'll call.
Ted the Power Man, eyes wide and teary, made a lunge for him. Two young men, one was the bartender, held him back.
Goodbye, Gardner said to the huddled knots of people. Thank you for a lovely time.
He went to the door, then turned back.
And if you forget everything else, remember about the leukemia and the children. Remember.
But what they'd remember was him whacking Ted with the umbrella. He saw it in their faces. Gardner nodded and went down the hallway past Arberg, who was still standing with his hands clutched to his chest, lips flexing and closing. Gardner did not look back. He kicked aside the litter of umbrellas, opened the door, and stepped out into the night. He wanted a drink more than he ever had in his life, and he supposed he must have found one, because that was when he fell into the belly of the big fish, and the blackout swallowed him. Chapter 6 Gardner on the Rock. 1. Not long after dawn, on the morning of July 4th, 1988, Gardner awoke, came to, anyway, near the end of the stone breakwater which extends out into the Atlantic, not far from the Arcadia Fun World Amusement Park in Arcadia Beach, New Hampshire. Not that Gardner knew where he was, then. He barely knew anything save for his own name, the fact that he was in what seemed to be total physical agony, and the somewhat less important fact that he had apparently almost drowned in the night. He was lying on his side, feet trailing in the water. He supposed that he had been high and dry when he had waltzed out here the night before, but he had apparently rolled over in his sleep, slid a little way down the breakwater's slope north side, and now the tide was coming in. If he had been half an hour later in waking up, he thought he very well might have simply floated off the rocks of the breakwater as a grounded ship may float off a sandbar. One of his loafers was still on, but it was shriveled and useless. Gardner kicked it off and watched apathetically as it floated down into greeny darkness. Something for the lobsters to shit in, he thought, and sat up. The bolt of pain which went through his head was so immense, he thought for a moment that he was having a stroke, that he had survived his night on the breakwater, only to die of an embolism the morning after. The pain receded a little, and the world came back from the gray mist into which it had receded. He was able to appreciate just how miserable he was. It was what Bobby Anderson would undoubtedly have called the whole-body trip, as in, savor the whole-body trip, Jim. What can be better than the way you feel after a night in the eye of the cyclone? A night? One night? No way, baby, this had been a jag, the real fucking thing. His stomach felt sour and bloated. His throat and sinuses were caked with elderly puke. He looked to his left, and sure enough, there it was, a little above him in what must have been his original position, the drinker's signature, a great big splash of drying vomit. Gardner wiped the shaking, dirty right hand under his nose and saw flakes of dried blood. He'd had a nosebleed. He'd had them off and on ever since the skiing accident at Sunday River when he was 17. He could almost count on the nosebleeds when he had been drinking. At the end of all his previous binges, and this was the first time he had gone whole hog in almost 3 years, Gardner had felt what he was feeling now, a sickness that went deeper than the thudding head, the stomach curled up like a sponge filled with acid, the aches, the quivering muscles. That deep sickness couldn't even be called depression. It was a feeling of utter doom. This was the worst ever. Even worse than the depression that had followed the famous Thanksgiving jag of 1980, the one that had ended his teaching career and his marriage. It had also come close to ending Nora's life. He had come to that time in Penobscot County Jail. A deputy was sitting outside his cell reading a copy of Crazy magazine and picking his nose. Gardner learned later that all police departments are aware that jag drinkers frequently come off their binges deeply depressed. So if there happens to be a man available, he keeps an eye on you to make sure you don't high-side it, at least not until you post bond and get off county property. Where am I? Gardner had asked. Where do you think you are? The deputy asked. He looked at the large green booger he had just scraped out of his nose, and then wiped it slowly and with apparent enjoyment onto the sole of his shoe, squashing it down, smearing it along the dark dirt there. Gardner had been unable to take his eyes from this operation. A year later, he would write a poem about it. What did I do? Save for occasional flashes, the previous 2 days had been totally black. The flashes were unrelated, like cloud rifts, which let through uncertain flickers of sunlight as a storm approaches. Bringing Nora a cup of tea, and then starting to harangue her about the nukes. Ave nukea eterna. When he died, his final word on the whole fucking mess wouldn't be Rosebud, but nukes. He could remember falling down in the driveway beside his house, getting a pizza, and being so drunk, runny clots of cheese went down inside his shirt, burning his chest. He could remember calling Bobby. Calling and babbling something to her, something awful. And had Nora been screaming? Screaming? What did I do? He asked more urgently. The deputy looked at him for a moment with a perfect, clear-eyed contempt. Shot your wife? That's what you did. Good fucking deal, huh? The deputy had gone back to his crazy magazine. That had been bad. This was worse. That deathless feeling of self-contempt. The grisly certainty that you had done bad things you couldn't remember. Not a few too many glasses of champagne at the New Year's Eve party, where you put a lampshade on your head and boogied around the room with it slipping down over your eyes, everybody in attendance, with the exception of your wife, thinking it was just the funniest thing they'd ever seen in their lives. Not knowing you did fun things, like punching department heads or shooting your wife. It had been worse this time. How could it be worse than Nora? Something. For the time being, his head hurt too badly to even try reconstructing the last unknown period of time. Gardner looked down at the water, the waves bulging smoothly up toward where he sat, forearms on his knees, head sagging. When the trough passed, he could see barnacles and slick green seaweed. No, not really seaweed. Green slime. Like boogers.
Shot your wife. Good fucking deal, huh?
Gardner closed his eyes against the sickening pulses of pain, then opened them again.
Jump in,
a voice cajoled him softly.
I mean, what the fuck, you don't really need any more of this shit, do you? Game called in the bottom of the first? Not official. Rain out. To be rescheduled when the great wheel of karma turns into the next life. Or the one after that, if I have to spend the next making up for this one by being a dung beetle or something. Hang up your jock guard. Jump in. In your current state, both of your legs will cramp and it'll be over quick. Gotta be the bed sheet in jail anyway. Go on. Jump.
He got up and stood swaying on the rocks, looking at the water. Just one big step, that's all it would take. He could do it in his sleep.
Shit, almost had. Not yet. Want to talk to Bobby first.
The part of his mind which still wanted a little to live grasped at this idea. Bobby. Bobby was the only part of his old life that still seemed somehow whole and good. Bobby was living down there in Haven, writing her western, still sane, still his friend, if no longer his lover. His last friend.
Want to talk to Bobby first, okay?
Why? So you can make a last stab at fucking her up, too?
God knows you've tried hard enough. She's got a police record because of you, and undoubtedly her own FBI folder as well. Leave Bobby out of this. Jump and stop fucking around.
He swayed forward, very close to doing it. The part of him that still wanted to live seemed to have no arguments left, no delaying tactic. It could have said that he had stayed sober, more or less, for the last 3 years. There had been no blackout since he and Bobby had been arrested at Seabrook in 1985. But that was a hollow argument. Except for Bobby, he was now completely alone. His mind was in turmoil almost all of the time, returning again and again, even sober, to the subject of the nukes. He recognized that his original concern and anger had rotted into obsession, but recognition and rehabilitation were not the same things at all. His poetry had deteriorated. His mind had deteriorated. Worst of all, when he wasn't drinking, he wished he was.
It's just that the hurting's all the time now. I'm like a bomb walking around and looking for a place to go off. Time to defuse.
Okay, then. Okay. He closed his eyes and got ready. As he did, an odd certainty came to him. An intuition so strong that it was nearly precognitive. He felt that Bobby needed to talk to him, rather than the other way around. That it was no mind trick. She really was in some kind of trouble. Bad trouble. He opened his eyes and looked around, like a man coming out of a deep daze. He would find a phone and call her. He wouldn't say, "Hey, Bobby, I had another blackout." And he wouldn't say, "I don't know where I am, Bobby, but this time there's no nose-picking deputy to stop me." He would say, "Hey, Bobby, how you doing?" And when she told him she was doing okay, never better, shooting it out with the James Gang in Northfield, or lighting out for the territories with Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and by the way, Guard, how's your own bad self? Guard would tell her he was fine, writing some good stuff for a change, thinking of going over Vermont way for a bit, see some friends. Then he would go back out to the end of the breakwater and jump off. Nothing fancy, he would just belly flop into the dead zone. That seemed to fit. After all, it was the way he had mostly gotten through the live one. The ocean had been here for a billion years. It would wait another 5 minutes while he did that.
But no laying it off on her, you hear me? Promise, Guard. No breaking down and blubbering. You're supposed to be her friend, not the male equivalent of her slime bucket sister. None of that shit.
He had broken promises in his life, God knew, a few thousand of them to himself. But this one he would keep. He climbed clumsily up to the top of the breakwater. It was rough and rocky, a really fine place to break an ankle. He looked around apathetically for his scuffed brown tote bag, the one he always took with him when he went off to read or just to ramble, thinking it might be lodged in one of the holes between the rocks. It wasn't. It was an old campaigner, scuffed and battered, going back to the last troubled years of his marriage, something he had managed to hold on to while all the valuable things got lost. Well, now the tote was finally gone, too. Clothes, toothbrush, bar of soap and a plastic dish, a bunch of jerky meat sticks. It amused Bobby to cure jerky in her shed sometimes. A $20 bill under the tote's bottom, and all his unpublished poems, of course. The poems were the least of his worries, the ones he had written over the last couple of years, and to which he had given the wonderfully witty and upbeat title, The Radiation Cycle, had been submitted to 5 different publishers and rejected by all 5. One anonymous editor had scribbled, "Poetry and politics rarely mix. Poetry and propaganda, never." This little homily was perfectly true. He knew it, and still hadn't been able to stop. Well, the tide had administered the ultimate blue pencil to them. "Go and do thou likewise," he thought, and lurched slowly along the breakwater toward the beach, thinking that his walk out to where he had awakened must have been better than a death-defying circus act. He walked with the summer sun rising up red and bloated from the Atlantic behind him, his shadow trailing out in front of him. And on the beach, a kid in jeans and a t-shirt set off a string of firecrackers. 2. A marvel. His tote bag wasn't lost after all. It was lying upside down on the beach just above the high tide line, unzipped, looking to Gardner like a big leather mouth biting at the sand. He picked it up and looked inside. Everything was gone, even his frayed undies. He pulled up the tote's imitation leather bottom. The 20 was gone, too. Fond hope, too quickly banished. Gardner dropped the tote. His notebooks, all 3 of them, lay a little further along the beach. One was resting on its covers in a tent shape. One lay soggily just below the high tide line, swelled up to the size of a telephone book, and the wind was leafing through the 3rd idly. "Don't bother," Gardner thought. "Lees of an ass." The kid with the firecrackers came toward him, but not too close. "Wants to be able to take off in a hurry if I turn out to be as weird as I undoubtedly look," Gardner thought. "Smart kid." "That your stuff?" the kid asked. His t-shirt showed a guy blowing his groceries. "School lunch victim," the shirt said. "Yeah," Gardner said. He bent down and picked up the soggy notebook, looked at it for a moment, and then tossed it down again. The kid handed him the other 2. What could he say? "Don't bother, kid. The poems suck, kid. Poetry and politics rarely mix, kid. Poetry and propaganda never." "Thanks," he said. "Sure." The kid held the bag so Gardner could drop the 2 dry notebooks back inside. "Surprised you got anything left at all. This place is full of rip-off artists in the summer. The park, I guess." The kid gestured with his thumb, and Gardner saw the roller coaster silhouetted against the sky. Guard's first thought was that he had somehow managed to roister all the way north to Old Orchard Beach before collapsing. A second look changed his mind. No pier. "Where am I?" Gardner asked, and his mind harked back with an eerie totality to the jail cell and the nose-picking deputy. For a moment he was sure the kid would say, "Where do you think you are?" "Arcadia Beach." The kid looked half amused, half contemptuous. "You must have really hung one on last night, mister." "Last night and the night before," Gardner chanted, his voice a little rusty, a little eerie. Tommyknockers, knocking at the door." The boy blinked at Gardner in surprise, and then delighted him by unexpectedly adding a couplet Gardner had never heard. "Wanna go out, don't know if I can, 'cause I'm so afraid of the Tommyknocker man." Gardner grinned, but the grin turned into a wince of fresh pain.
"Where'd you hear that, kid?"
"My mom, when I was a baby."
"I heard about the Tommyknockers from my mother, too," Gardner said. "But never that part.
The kid shrugged as if the topic had lost whatever marginal interest it might have had for him. She used to make all kinds of stuff up. He appraised Gardner.
Don't you ache?
Kid,
Gardner said, leaning forward solemnly.
In the immortal words of Ed Sanders and Tuli Kupferberg, I feel like homemade shit.
You look like you've been drunk a long time.
Yeah, how would you know?
My mom. With her, it was always funny stuff like the Tommyknockers, or too hungover to talk.
She give it up?
Yeah. Car crash, the kid said. Gardner was suddenly racked with shivers. The boy appeared not to notice. He studied the sky, tracing the path of a gull. It coursed a morning sky of blue, delicately shelled with mackerel scales, turning black for a moment as it flew in front of the sun's rising red eye. It landed on the breakwater, where it began to pick at something which gulls presumably found tasty. Gardner looked from the gull to the kid. All of this was taking on decidedly omenish tones. The kid knew about the fabled Tommyknockers. How many kids in the world knew about them? And what were the odds that Gardner would happen to stumble on one who both A, knew about them, and B, had lost his mother because of drink? The kid reached in his pocket and brought out a small tangle of firecrackers.
Sweet bird of you,
Gard thought and smiled.
Want to light a couple? Celebrate the 4th? Might cheer you up.
The 4th? The 4th of July? Is that what this is?
The kid gave him a dry smile.
It ain't Arbor Day.
The 26th of June had been. He counted backward.
Good Christ, he had 8 days, which were painted black.
Well, not quite. That actually would have been better.
Patches of light, not at all welcome, were beginning to illuminate parts of that blackness. The idea that he had hurt someone, again, arose now in his mind as a certainty. Did he want to know who that
Argle Bargle
was, or what he had done to him or her? Probably not. Best to call Bobby and finish himself before he remembered. Mister, how'd you get that scar on your forehead?
Ran into a tree while I was skiing.
Bet it hurt.
Yeah, even worse than this, but not by much.
Do you know where there's a payphone?
The kid pointed to an eccentric green-roofed manse, which stood perhaps a mile down the beach. It topped a crumbling granite headland and looked like the cover of a paperback gothic. It had to be a resort. After a moment's fumbling, Gard came up with a name.
That's the Alhambra, isn't it?
The one and only.
Thanks,
he said and started off.
Mister?
He turned.
Don't you want that last book?
The kid pointed to the wet notebook lying on the high tide line.
You could dry it out.
Gardner shook his head.
Kid,
he said,
I can't even dry me out.
You sure you don't want to light off some firecrackers?
Gardner shook his head, smiling.
Be careful with them, okay? People hurt themselves with things that go bang.
Okay. He smiled a little shyly. My mother did for a long time before the... You know.
I know. What's your name?
Jack. What's yours?
Guard.
Happy 4th of July, Guard.
Happy 4th, Jack. And watch out for the Tommyknockers.
Knocking at my door.
The kid agreed solemnly, and looked at Gardner with eyes which seemed queerly knowing. For a moment, Gardner seemed to feel a second premonition.
Whoever would have guessed a hangover was so conducive to the psychic emanations of the universe?
A bitterly sarcastic voice inside asked. He didn't know what of, exactly, but it filled him with urgency about Bobby again. He tipped the kid a wave and set off up the beach. He walked at a fast, steady pace, although the sand drew at his feet, clinging, pulling. Soon his heart was racing and his head was thudding so hard his eyeballs seemed to pulse. The Alhambra did not seem to be drawing appreciably closer.
Slow down or you'll have a heart attack, or a stroke, or both.
He did slow down.
and then doing so struck him as palpably absurd. Here he was, planning to drown himself in 15 minutes or so, but minding his heart in the meantime. It was like the old joke about the condemned man turning down a cigarette offered by the captain of the firing squad. "I'm trying to quit," the guy says. Gardner picked up his pace again, and now the bolts of pain began to beat out steady pulses of jingle-jangle verse. Late last night and the night before, Tommyknockers knocking at the door. I was crazy and Bobby was sane, but that was before the Tommyknockers came. He stopped. What is this Tommyknocker shit? Instead of an answer, that deep voice, as terrifying and yet as sure as the voice of a loon crying out on an empty lake, came back.
Bobby's in trouble.
He began to walk again, getting up to his former brisk pace, and then moving even faster.
Want to go out?
He thought.
Don't know if I can, because I'm so afraid of the Tommyknocker man.
He was climbing the weather-whitened stairs which led up the side of the granite headland from the beach to the hotel when he wiped his hand across his nose and saw that it was bleeding again. 3. Gardner lasted exactly 11 seconds in the lobby of the Alhambra, long enough for the desk clerk to see he had no shoes on. The clerk nodded to a husky bellman when Gardner began to protest, and the two of them gave him the bum's rush.
They would have booted me even if I had been wearing shoes,
Gard reflected.
Shit, I would have booted me.
He had gotten a good look at himself in the glass of the lobby door. Too good. He had managed to mop most of the blood off his face with his sleeve, but there were still traces. His eyes were bloodshot and starry. His week's growth of beard made him look like a porcupine about 6 weeks after a shearing. In the genteel summer world of the Alhambra, where men were men and women wore tennis skirts, he looked like a male bag lady. Because only the earliest risers had begun to stir, the bellman took the time to inform him there was a payphone at the mobile station.
Intersection of U.S. 1 and Route 26. Now get the hell out before I call the cops.
If he had needed to know any more about himself than he already did, it was in the husky bellman's disgusted eyes. Gardner trudged slowly down the hill toward the gas station. His socks flapped and flailed against the tar. His heart knocked like a wheezy Model T engine that's experienced too much hard traveling and too little maintenance. He could feel the headache moving to the left, where it would eventually center in a brilliant pinpoint, if he'd had plans to live that long, anyway. And suddenly he was 17 again. He was 17, and his obsession wasn't nukes, but Nookie. The girl's name was Anne Marie, and he thought he was going to make it with her pretty soon, maybe, if he didn't lose his nerve, if he kept his cool. Maybe even tonight. But part of keeping his cool was doing okay today. Today, right here. Here being Straight Arrow, an intermediate ski trail at Victory Mountain in Vermont. He was looking down at his skis, mentally reviewing the steps necessary to come to your basic snowplow stop, reviewing as he would study for a test, wanting to pass, knowing he was still pretty new at this and Anne Marie wasn't, and he somehow didn't think she would be so apt to come across if he ended up looking like Frosty the Snowman his first day off the beginner slope. He didn't mind looking a little inexperienced, as long as he didn't look downright stupid. So there he had been, looking stupidly down at his feet instead of where he was going, which was directly at a gnarled old pine, with a warning red stripe painted on its bark, and the only sounds were the wind in his ears and the snow sliding dryly under his skis, and they were the same soothing hush-a-bye sound. Shh. It was the rhyme that broke into the memory, making him stop near the mobile station. The rhyme came back, and it stayed, beating in time with his throbbing head. Late last night and the night before, Tommyknockers knocking at the door. Guard Hawk tasted the coppery, unpleasant flavor of his own blood, and spat a reddish glob of phlegm into the trash-littered dirt of the soft shoulder. He remembered asking his mother who or what Tommyknockers were. He couldn't remember what, if anything, she had replied, but he'd always thought they must be highwaymen, robbers who stole by moonlight, killed in shadow, and buried in the darkest part of the night. And hadn't he spent one tortured, endless half-hour in the darkness of his bedroom before sleep finally decided to be merciful and claim him, thinking they might be cannibals as well as robbers. that instead of burying their victims in the dark of the night, they might have cooked them and...
well...
Gardner wrapped his thin arms, there didn't seem to be any restaurants up in the Cyclone, around his chest and shuddered. He crossed to the mobile station, which was hung with bunting, but not yet open. The signs out front read, "Super Unleaded, .99, and God Bless America, and We Love Winnebagos." The payphone was on the side of the building. Gardner was grateful to find it was one of the new ones. You could dial long distance without depositing any money. That, at least, spared him the indignity of spending part of his last morning on Earth panhandling. He punched zero, then had to stop. His hand was shaking wildly. It was all over the place. He cocked the phone between head and shoulder this time, leaving both hands free. Grasped his right wrist with his left hand to hold the hand steady as possible anyway. Now, looking like a shooter on a target range, he used his forefinger to punch the buttons with slow and horrible deliberation. The robot voice told him to punch in either his telephone credit card number, a task Gard thought he would have been utterly incapable of performing, even if he'd had such a card, or zero for an operator. Gardner hit zero.
"Hi, happy holiday, this is Eileen," a voice chirruped. "May I have your billing, please?"
"Hi, Eileen, happy holiday to you too," Gard said. "I'd like to bill the call collect to anyone from Jim Gardner."
"Thank you, Jim."
"You're welcome," he said, and then suddenly, "No, change that. Tell her it's Gard calling."
As Bobby's telephone began to ring up there in Haven, Gardner turned and looked toward the rising sun. It was even redder than before, rising toward the scud of thickening mackerel scales like a great round blister in the sky. End of side 3. To continue, turn the cassette over.